Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
And welcome to another exciting episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. I am your moderator, Jonathan, a proud member of the Nordic Kingdoms this week. And as always, to my left...
My name is Trevor, and I am a member of the Russviet Union.
I'm Robert, and this week I'm part of the Saxon Empire.
And we are, of course, talking about the different factions within Scythe, which will be our review game of today. But before we get to that, we have a lot of other exciting, fun stuff to talk about. So as always, we are going to start out with our theme of the month. And Trevor, what is the theme of the month this month?
Our theme of the month, this one's a little unusual. It is Sword and Planet, which is a genre that not everyone may be familiar with, but it is kind of the pulp mashup of science fiction, fantasy, and early 1930s adventure stories.
It's most also known as planetary romance. We found it there too.
Ooh. Yeah, planetary romance is kind of the
It's the over genre. This is the dialed in one.
Yeah. So the most famous example of this would be the Princess of Mars and its sequels by Edgar Rice Burroughs, following the adventures.
Or if you watch the movie, John Carter.
Yeah, John Carter. Well, John Carter...
Because everybody watched that movie. It was a cultural touchstone.
Yes, yeah. Apparently all three of you.
That movie was literally so insignificant that even making fun of it isn't really all that funny. Like that's kind of why I'm just sort of like shrugging my shoulders at you right now. The comic book that spun off of that was actually pretty rad, though. So anyway, what that means is on the site, we're going to have a couple of classes that are kind of themed around that genre. Maybe some... kind of blending a little bit of outer space retro 50s sci-fi weirdness with your Dungeons & Dragons
campaigns. And if you think about it, like John Carter, I mean, they did that old like Clark adage where they had technology that might as well be magic sometimes, and it was kind of a D&D world. Like, it was filled with, you know, barbarian, because there were like these, I was reading about the Green Martians, and there were these cities that the ancients built that the Green Martians, which are basically like orcs of the setting, just sort of rolled into and said, these are ours now, we live here. Well, and they had a cultural identity around all these cities, and then they war with each other.
Yeah, well, and they have airships, and they have like, you know, like kind of weird occult like prophecies
and
stuff like
that. But that's
what
the theme's going to be about. It's easy to retheme a D&D game, or maybe you just take a sidetrack to whatever your campaign setting's Mars is.
All right, and alongside that, we've actually come up with some board game recommendations for that theme as well. A couple of Victorian steampunk-style board games. The first one that comes to mind is Mission Red Planet, which is a fantastic worker placement game that is all about the colonization and exploitation of Mars.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Planet Steam, which is Victorian-style steampunk. Again, that's kind of a resource management game. The other one that comes to mind is On Her Majesty's Service, which is this weird gothic steampunk game that takes place in, it's kind of like a dimension between life and death, and it's a really neat mechanic game where you're constantly rotating chunks of the board, which is really fun.
That's cool.
It was a cool Mini or Not game, so it's got these amazing busts that represent the different characters in the game. And then finally, if you're looking for something a little more modern from the golden age of sci-fi, which would be, you know, late 1940s, early 1950s sci-fi, Space Cadets Away Missions, which is a 1-6 player co-op game.
Mm-hmm.
Fully co-op, full campaign, really neat game.
Cool. And yeah, all of those are just to help check it out to kind of get you in the mood for some kind of, again, sort of a retro sci-fi feeling month.
And a little later on in the show, we're actually going to be talking about Scythe from Jamie Stegmaier, which definitely fits the theme as well. It's a 1920s science fiction universe with big stompy steam mechs.
Yeah, it's a very that one's got a very interesting vibe because it has a very agrarian, like pastoral sort
yes.
of feel to it. But there are just giant robots too. So, and we'll
just hanging around, you know,
cows, yeah. goats, and mechs. Who
yeah,
doesn't
yeah.
want that, right?
Yeah, we will get very in depth into Scythe because
that was good times.
That was a good game.
All right, so now that we've talked about the theme, let's go ahead and talk about what we've gotten off the shelf in the last couple of weeks. And Trevor, let's start with you. What have you had off the shelf lately?
Well, I've been really into Savage Rifts again. I think we mentioned that on the last show that I'm a big Rifts fan. And the second PDF in the early access just came out, the Game Master's Guide. Which has a lot of interesting stuff. They've actually got a random adventure generation chapter, which, like, literally has multiple tables you roll on to come up with all of the different plot elements for your Savage Tale and Savage Rifts. So I'm kind of tinkering around with that and kind of rereading some of my old Palladium Rifts books, trying to work on a campaign, which hopefully you guys will be playing in very soon. I did go play the pre-release for Eldritch Moon, the new Magic the Gathering set. I bombed out horribly. I went 0-2.
Shame.
And then I've got some TV and video games to talk about, but we'll come back to that in a second.
And how about you, Robert? What have you had off the shelf lately?
We're still playing Knights Black Agents. Well, we canceled last session, but we're still going strong on that. I recently reread The Bubblegum Shoe, mainly because we posted a review of it on the site, which has been doing pretty well, so go check it out. I think it's just called Bubblegum Shoe, a teen story detective game, something like that, a review. Jonathan and I had like a little game night thing.
Impromptu.
Yeah, and he taught me Splendor. And then I got to, like live the dream and teach you back Lords of Waterdeep, which is, like...
Which is an awesome game.
Yeah, well, it's... I never get to teach you anything.
You guys played Lords of Waterdeep without me? That's so unfair.
It was... We threw our kids at each other, man. It happens.
Yeah. The Night is Young.
The Night is Young, sure, yeah.
So for folks that haven't heard of either of those games, we should just kind of really briefly dive into them. Splendor is a really neat kind of a... It's a
engine building
game.
Yeah, where you trade gems and do stuff.
Yeah, you start out with no mines and no money, and you start collecting gems that are on poker chips. And once you have enough to afford to be able to purchase one, you're basically purchasing a mine.
And
once
the mine generates gems and
exactly.
DPs. And so,
so it's
so
kind of like it, like Infernal Machine or one of the other like kind of. Rube Goldberg-y type of games where, like,
kinda.
As you build stuff, it, like...
It's a little more simplified than that. It's straight engine building.
The only thing I could compare
economic
to
engine.
Yeah.
Is Agricola, but it's way, way, way less complex.
Yeah,
which is
super
nice, because you can just bomb it out, which is better, in my opinion.
Yeah. And then the other one is...
Lords of Waterdeep.
Yeah, Lords of Waterdeep.
Which is one of my favorite games. I was so shocked when I played the game. Like, I mean, I'm a cynical hater. I should really knock it off. But I went into that game, it's like, oh, Wizards of the Coast making a Euro game? This is going to be bad. No, it's really good.
Yeah, no. It's very streamlined. It's very straightforward. And most importantly, it's simple that you can get it very quickly and teach it very quickly. But it's deep enough that there's lots of different ways to win it, and it's... genuinely fun. It's really good.
One of my callouts I want to make about Lords of Waterdeep that I really appreciate about the game is that the D&D skin over it, I guess is the best way to put it, is it's a great thing for the people that like Forgotten Realms lore. Like, all of the things are recognizable and there's a lot of great D&D references, but you absolutely do not have to know anything about D&D to enjoy Lords of Waterdeep. It is a great game on its own.
Oh, it was hilarious. His kid was sitting on Jonathan's lap and he's like, you know, what's that? And I'm like a Realms nerd, so I was like, that's that, this is what they do there, and blah blah blah. And he's like, oh, what's that? And he was I could tell he was trying to get me. And I'm like, oh, son, we can go down this rabbit hole.
You don't know me. You don't know what I've seen.
But despite Rob flexing his Forgotten Realms cred, which I was not aware a thing that existed until today, it's a good game.
Well, but that's my point.
He stuffed that 3-year-old down.
Yeah, but down. Not knowing any of that, did that take away from your enjoyment of that game?
No, not at all. In fact, I would go as far as to say that for the non-D&D person, it's just, like you said, it's just a skin. But for the D&D person, they've actually taken the time to make it more than a skin. It actually is integrated deeply into the gameplay. Like, the quests make sense. Just even the function.
Well, there's a lot,
like,
of references to adventures and books. And
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
But that's just it. It's just references. And, like, if you look at something and you don't get it, I mean, it's not that you're not going to get it. It's like, oh, this quest doesn't make sense to me. It's just a title. It's just if you haven't read that book, you're like, oh, they're talking about this. Or they're talking about that video game.
It's the level of depth that the more D&D knowledge you know, the more you're going to get out of it. But you still get plenty out of the game.
Yeah.
For the 30-second review, it's a fantastic game. It's a real light Euro that's easy to teach. And I think all three of us highly recommend it.
Yeah, definitely love that one.
So I tried out Once Upon a Time with my wife, which I don't recommend playing that game with two people, but it's a cute little game where you just get a handful of cards that have story elements and you try to tie a story together. I've been mainly on this quest to buy games I can play with my kids, and that is definitely one of them. Unfortunately, you do kind of need to be able to read for that, so my 4-year-old is not anywhere near playing that game, but it's a fun little game. I had a good time with her.
I was elected to lead, not to read.
And then been playing the War Machine Mark III. So I've gotten 3 games in now. I play trolls, so I did a Calandra game with Beasts and Champions against a Cador Jack Spam thing, and I tabled the guy. I did Ragnar with Colossals, and I lost. And then I did, or Colossals, Gargantuans. And then I did Ragnar with a more traditional list, and I ran, and I have painted some stuff, which was fun.
Yeah, you painted, actually, the first player marker from a Kickstarter I got recently called Apex Theropod, which is a giant T-Rex. I've named him Franklin, and he is so impressive.
Nice.
Yeah, he's right over there.
Yeah.
Let's see, what have I had on the table? Of course, we all had a chance to sit down and play Scythe together as we were preparing for the review. The quick of it all is it's fantastic, but you'll get to learn so much more detail a little later on in the show. My Pandemic Legacy campaign continued. 3 months in a row, we have pulled out a win on the very last turn with not enough cards for one more turn, and we've just squeaked it out.
Nice.
But the legacy elements are getting very difficult. The game, like, I didn't think Pandemic could get harder. It turns out I was wrong. It's getting harder with every single game. There's, all right, just minor spoiler alert here. If you don't want any spoilers about your Pandemic Legacy, fast forward about 30 seconds. One of the things that happens is basically a pseudo-zombie invasion, and they take over cities, and then the cities no longer produce disease cubes. They produce zombies, and it's just one more thing you have to track. Except, fun fact, you have no way of destroying the zombies, so you can't let them pile up. You have to quarantine the cities before they pile up and spill out. It's
interesting.
It's really hairy. And now back to our non-spoiler-free segments. Yeah, so like you said, Robert, you and I sat down and played Splendor and Lords of Waterdeep, which was awesome. You've been pouring Kador rules into my head with War Machine, and I have now sat down with you and built a giant army that I'm now preparing to take into battle as I read through the rules and try and do the list-building activities myself. But yeah, at this point, I've got enough stuff together that I can actually build a 75-point army, which is very exciting for me, so I cannot wait to deploy them. But that's about all I've had on the table. It's been kind of slow, other than some general Star Realms and Cthulhu Realms.
All right. Are we going to talk about other media now?
Yeah. I mean, okay. I think for all three of us, I think it's fair to say Overwatch, Overwatch, Overwatch.
Yeah.
Overwatch.
Competitive hit between podcasts.
I actually had a chance to play the Battlefield 1 closed alpha.
Oh, neat. I'm actually interested in that, because World War One is not well-covered territory, so...
So let's get the awkward stuff out of the way. Most of the weapons are what would have been considered kind of, like, slightly advanced for the era. They wouldn't have been available in large quantities.
Yeah, they're usually very obscure. I remember I was actually watching
They're all time period accurate. It's just that most of them were research and development at the time.
Yeah,
they weren't actively...
I'm kind of a gun weirdo, and I actually watch a YouTube channel that is literally all about old, obscure guns. And the guy who ran that channel did a breakdown, and he pointed out that one of the rifles that you can get on the Italian side, three of them were ever made. Like, period. There were three.
But I understand that, right? They're trying to make balance, and let's face it, it'd be like trying to make a game out of a Civil War. It's like, you can't just fire a musket once every 25 seconds. That's just not fun. You have to kind of have game in there. But that being said, if we look at Battlefield history, I would say this actually feels closest to Bad Company 2. The environments are extremely destructible. Like, the most destruction we've seen since Battlefield 2. The graphics are really nice. I mean, this is the first game that's not being scaled up from the previous console generation, like 4 was. Because Battlefield 4, it's like, yeah, okay, you've made this great, fantastic, flexible engine, but there's no reason why I should be able to play this on an Xbox 360 and an Xbox One, you know?
Yeah.
The Xbox One version suffered because it had to be so scalable. So now that they've gotten rid of this, like, the graphics have taken a large jump forward. The weapon selection is good. The classes are very well balanced and interesting. It's classic Battlefield classes, but they've been tweaked a little bit. You can do all the kinds of stuff that you can normally do. Terrain deformation is like a huge part of the game. When artillery comes down, it hugely impacts the terrain, which can mean that the tanks have a hard time getting through and oftentimes get stuck, which I thought was really neat.
Yeah, I have one more thing that I just wanted to talk about. You may have heard of a Netflix show called Stranger Things at this point. By the time this comes out, you will probably have to have been living under a rock not to have heard of it. I watched it yesterday because I was homesick from work and blew through the entire thing in one day. It is probably one of the better sci-fi shows to come out in a really long time. I don't want to spoil anything because there are spoilers pretty much right from the get-go. The show is very I won't say that the show is totally unpredictable, because it's relying on a lot of, like, nostalgic tropes. There are references to Stephen King, references to Spielberg movies like E.T., references to kids' movies from the 80s like The Goonies.
Stephen King actually tweeted about it.
Well, yeah.
He said it's, like, Stephen King's greatest hits, and I mean that in a good way.
Yeah, well, they actually... there's even a direct shout-out to Stephen King in the show.
That's cool.
There's also, like, shout-outs to, like, The X-Files, to... So pretty much every kind of sci-fi horror thing that shaped our childhoods is kind of run together. But the thing that's awesome about it is that instead of just relying on the nostalgia, they also do it in the slick and very creepy style of a modern horror show. Like, it's the visuals and the sound and the atmosphere is like the best moments on American Horror Story, you know. It's got that feel to it. And, like, there were parts where I was, like, legitimately, like jumping in my chair, like, oh my god, like, you know, like, so it's a very, very good show. If you've not watched it yet, go binge watch it on Netflix. It is 8 hours. You will not regret.
Netflix is on a tear.
Yeah, they've been doing a lot of really good stuff lately. I haven't watched
Stranger
all of
Things
it.
Almost came out of nowhere too.
Yeah, like it got like no buzz, and then it came out this last weekend, and everybody was like, "Holy crap!" Yeah, like, watch the show.
I just finished Daredevil season two recently,
oh, yeah,
and
so
was
good.
Floored by it. And that's like one of the few times that I've actually been able to see a show incorporate ninjas in a manner that didn't make me go, "This is ridiculous."
I
it was like legit ninjas.
Yeah,
like I was totally into it.
I still giggled a little bit during certain parts when like there was ninja spam, but I will say they actually made the ninjas sufficiently menacing and not just a joke.
And now it's time for the Wisdom of Crowd, our tabletop crowdfunding and news segment. And we're going to start out today with a brand new addition to Kickstarter. It actually just hit this morning, and that is Near and Far from Ryan Lockett and Red Raven Game.
So fill us in on this one, because I'm not super familiar with this product line, but you seem to be a fan.
Yes, well, okay, so first of all, it should be said, for full disclosure, I'm a huge Ryan Lockett super fanboy. I have all of his games. They're beautiful, they're gorgeous, they're fun, and they're very elegant in terms of design. They're very simple and to the point, but not in terms of a depth perspective, in terms of a gameplay perspective. It's simple to pick up, but infinitely deep. And Near and Far is actually a sequel to a game that he released 2 years ago called Above and Below. And Above and Below is a worker placement game, part engine builder, part worker placement. So you secure areas both above and below the ground that let you build new structures, which let you build basically a resource engine. At the same time, you can also get workers, and each of these workers has two values. They can be placed anywhere on the map in one of the worker spaces to farm and generate resources.
Okay.
Or they can be sent exploring. When you go exploring, you actually have this book of little stories, and you turn to the page based off of a random card draw. And then you read a short passage, and then it gives you a decision on what you want to make. And then you do a dice roll to determine whether or not you're successful.
Well, and that's actually kind of similar to something in Scythe, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, kind of like the quest almost there.
Except it's a little more developed from a story perspective.
Yeah.
The neat thing is that some of the options that it gives you are very morally ambiguous. So it really kind of leaves you thinking, did you do the right thing? You know, which is kind of, it's neat that it leaves that impression.
Well, so what's different about this new one?
Well, Near and Far kind of takes it in a new direction. It does come with a storybook, just like Above and Below. But it's a much broader expanse. So Above and Below is kind of like village level. Near and Far is world level, where you're actually exploring the world rather than just the surrounding village area. Same basic mechanics. You can actually, if you spend an extra $10 to get some extra cardboard chits, you can actually make a conversion kit that allows you to fully take all the characters from Above and Below and interact with Near and Far and vice versa with Above and Below.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of a cool thing that a lot of companies are doing these days, because I remember one of the games we talked about last week by Cool Mini was doing a similar thing.
Yeah.
Which is always nice when you can bridge that together.
I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's like, it just gives you that much more replayability. In fact, I just got Ryan Lockett's last Kickstarter in the mail last week. It's called Islebound. You can use all the characters from Islebound in Above and Below by flipping the token upside down, and he actually printed the statistics for them to be active characters in Above and Below. So the big elements to keep in mind for Near and Far versus Above and Below are, because it has a larger scale, it actually comes with an atlas book. It's a 10-map campaign mode that lets you basically build your character over time. So Above and Below is very much a you play it once and that's your little story. this is all about the extended campaign.
So, this is almost like a legacy game
in a way. Exactly, yeah. Except that it's resettable and you don't have to worry about destroying it. You're not ripping any cards up.
Yeah, cool.
Giving me a minor heart attack.
Well, do you want to just run down the backer levels real fast on that one?
Yeah, backer levels are actually a little complicated. $3 just lets you hop in and be a part of the whole thing, get access to updates and whatnot. $14 gets you the printed labyrinth book. $20 gets you the jaunt level, which is just the cardboard tokens and everything that you need for Above and Below and the Desert Labyrinth book. $50 gets you a copy of Just Near and Far. And then $60 gets you a copy of basically Near and Far plus the Labyrinth books. And then $70 gets you everything plus the cardboard tokens so that you can fully incorporate Above and Below.
Real quick for people, if you already have Above and Below, the $70 level sounds like the best deal. If you don't,
absolutely.
What level would you recommend people jump in at? Would be like maybe the $50 one to just give it a shot? Or
you know, honestly, I would recommend everybody goes for the $70 just simply because if you end up liking the game, it gives you access to Above and Below later on, right?
Fair enough.
It's a relatively minor ask in terms of extra money, but it gives you the ability to fully link in and hold another game. The one thing to keep in mind is that Near and Far will come to retail eventually, but not in this version. This is going to be a deluxe version with metal coins and some other niceties that will not be included in the retail version.
So Rob and I have something to talk about, a D&D thing, which we totally called
in the last podcast.
D&D. Yep, D&D. All right, so Innistrad Planeshift got released. Rob, you want to fill us in?
Okay, so this one is a 40-page PDF. It is designed, again, to link up with the art book, The Art of Innistrad, that is out, although I don't have my copy yet. But it gives you all the roles you need to basically play in Innistrad, which is one of the planes of magic. It has a lot of horror themes to it, so, you know, vampires, werewolves, things that go bump in the night, and then the humans that go and slay them, because monster hunting, yeah.
Innistrad was kind of the first gritty magic setting in a lot of ways. Like, it was very...
There weren't as much, like, high fantasy elements. One of the items in frickin' the original Innistrad was just, like, a stake.
Yeah, or a pitchfork.
Humans
would, like, go stab werewolves with. Yeah,
it was awesome.
Yeah, so, and... Basically, everything on the plane wants to kill the humans. Yeah. The werewolves want to kill the humans. The vampires want to kill the humans. The devils.
The zombies, the ghosts, the demons. So what you get in this is there are just variant humans. There's four styles of variant humans.
Yeah, and what he means is there are no elves, no dwarves, no halflings. It is humans.
Humans, yes.
Yeah.
They're named after the various provinces of Innistrad. This one was nice because the classes got a little bit more of an overview, so they talked about where each of the major D&D classes sort of fit into the Innistrad world and which ones kind of don't.
Yeah, well, and they talked about like what magic cards like would represent a specific class, which is kind of neat.
They gave you a new background, like completely new, called the Inquisitor, which was pretty cool.
Inquisitors are always cool characters. Every series that has ever had one, they make it awesome.
Well, and it was nice that it was a new background, and it wasn't like a variant background. Like, they gave you a really solid new background to play
with. Yeah, it's got like full tables and everything, which is cool.
They gave a fairly long section on the Church of Avacyn and how the humans interact with it and how classes interact with it. There is a very long section on Innistrad monster variants, and a lot of it is the dragons of Innistrad are just red dragons, but they have a little bit different flavor. And it's a lot of that, but there's a few things to call out. Specifically, Geiss, they're very different in Innistrad compared to the ghosts of D&D, so they have a pretty long write-up.
Yeah, Geiss are basically different than ghosts. Rather than being a tormented spirit who got left behind, I mean, they have a little bit of that element, but Geiss actually retain a lot of their personality, so a lot of the Geiss actually team up with the humans and like help them out.
And the werewolves, it's mainly a tweak. The werewolves aren't as much of a curse. They give you a different sort of entry-level vampire called the Vampire Neonate, which is not like the Vampire Spawn. They're a little bit more independent, but that's about the biggest.
Yeah.
But they do have a new monster block write-up for them, so if you're in the mood to throw a new type of, you know, low-level vampire at your players, there's one in there. And then they have another new monster called the Creepy Doll, which is just straight a magic card, which is awesome.
They talk about how to take the various human monsters, like how to take a necromancer and make it into a ghoul caller, which is the Innistrad version. You also have the Stitchers, which are people that make like Frankenstein monsters, like flesh golems. They also have one of my favorite things is they talk about necro alchemy, which is like this weird form of magic that only exists on Innistrad, where people literally take geists or ghosts, stick them in bottles, and then use them as ammo to shoot at people. Like, you literally, you're literally firing ghost energy at people. So it's like the reverse of Ghostbuster proton packs, kind of. Like,
you suck them up in a trap and then you shoot them at people.
Yeah, yeah, and you actually see this in the art for a lot of the cards in Innistrad. You see these dudes with, like, these, like, crazy looking,
the most,
like,
famous of which is the Snapcaster Mage.
Yeah, Snapcaster Mage has this big old gun on his arm, and it is a Geist cannon. He, like, shoots ghosts at people. Yeah, so there's just a lot of, like, cool stuff like that.
The tail end of the packet talks about Emrakul coming, which is the storyline of the latest set, Eldritch Moon, which Emrakul is basically a Cthulhu.
She's an Eldrazi Titan, and the Eldrazi are basically the old ones of the Magic universe.
Yeah, yeah. And her thing is, she gets people, and as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, she just, like, jams living things together into a tentacly mess, like the thing.
No,
and
it's
disgusting.
Yeah,
there's two cards that I like. One of them is
it's like chittering
rats
and midnight scavengers.
Yeah, and then if you have them both on the table, they merge and you flip one of the cards over and it turns into this guy with, like, rats embedded in him.
Well, it's like a swarm of rats in, like, a humanoid shape, like, all shambling towards you. It's really disturbing.
And then they have one called the Galvany
Hanweir. It's Hanweir Township Garrison.
Hanweir Garrison. Okay, so yeah, you have the Hanweir Township, which is this, like, you know, fortified town, and then you have the guys who are manning the walls, and then if you have them both out at the same time, they flip over and it turns into this, like basically it looks like a town with, like, tentacles coming out of it, and the town's running around. It's like all the flesh from all the people got fused into one thing and took off.
Yeah, and it's this giant town running around.
Oh, and then the awesome. Two angels are gross.
Bruna and Gisela, who were two of Avacyn's, like, right-hand angels, they get merged into Brunella, who is this, like, horrifying, like,
two-headed,
Sephiroth monstrosity thing. It's gross, yeah.
But they give you rules for that. They give you rules to use the variant sanity mechanics from the Dungeon Master's Guide to show your slow corruption of Emrakul, which is pretty cool. And then the last couple pages is how to run Curse of Strahd in Innistrad instead of running it in Ravenloft.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So the point is, Innistrad is a rad setting. This gives you pretty much everything you need to convert it into your D&D game. So if you want to run a D&D game with a gothic horror setting, but you're kind of over Ravenloft, this is a great alternative and it has a lot of unique things to it. You should definitely check it out.
All right. So next up, we're going to talk about Power Grid the Card Game, which is a new game coming out from Rio Grande Games. And this is actually based off of the existing board game. So in Power Grid, it's a very Euro game that basically having you try and connect the most cities to create a giant grid of power. It's been a very well-received game. It's been around for quite a long time. It's actually a reskin of an old Friedman Fries game called, and I'm going to screw this up, Funkenschlag.
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 I think that actually means power grid in German.
Okay, there you go.
So, yeah.
The original Power Grid is actually very well received. It's carrying an 8 on Board Game Geek, which is
that's very high.
Yeah.
For Board Geek. Yeah, generally Board Game Geek over a 6 is good.
Yeah.
And in traditional Euro styling, the art is absolutely terrible and the gameplay is phenomenal. So they're actually taking the concept of Power Grid, the board game, and transferring it into a card game, which should be very interesting. There's not a ton of information available yet because it is just announced. And with Gen Con right around the corner, I think it's fair to say that we'll probably see a whole lot more then. It's going to be 2-6 player. Yeah, it says it takes about an hour to play, so that's reasonably quick. The MSRP is only going to be $19.95.
Well, there you go.
It's going to be like a Star Realm style game where you can get that cheap little box, take it with you, and do fun stuff with it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay. I love little card games like that.
So next up, we're going to talk about another Kickstarter, and this is kind of interesting because this is the first Kickstarter that I think all three of us have simultaneously backed.
This one got the vote of confidence from all of us.
That's a super good sign.
Yeah. For different reasons, but
I should make them a sticker.
Yeah. Right? Like you have the FMD trifecta.
Exactly.
The hat trick.
So this, of course, is Unity, which is an RPG system that's coming out on Kickstarter. So, Robert, why don't you tell us a little bit about Unity?
Okay, so first off, I watched the videos, and they're amazing because they're a little melodramatic, and I loved it.
Yeah,
I loved every moment of it.
It's the designer is a Canadian gentleman, and he's very enthusiastic about his product, and I in no way mean to make fun of him because he's actually pretty awesome, but he gets really into his descriptions of his games. It's like, and now my character narrated a story and brought everybody in and we were all so excited.
It's so awesome.
Yeah, he loves what he's doing.
Yeah, that's the best part. Like, this is such a passion project and it you can just see it.
It's part
really
of what
cool.
hooked me. I gotta be honest with you.
Yeah, I know.
He totally sold me on it.
I know, it's awesome.
If he's feeling it like that, I want to feel it like that.
Yeah.
The art style, it reminded me a lot of, like, kind of gave me like a Blizzard vibe, like a WoW/Diablo.
Oh yeah, no, totally, totally.
And the art is actually fairly impressive considering mainstream. This is just this dude's game. This isn't like a studio putting it out.
The Furion the best. The Furion is like phenomenal.
Yeah, they're like magma cat people. They look pretty rad.
Yeah, they kind of have the half-orc slot, I think. Let's get to the races. So there's humans, because, of course, high fantasy humans. There's the Vala, which kind of reminded me of Night Elves, but they have different fluff.
I was thinking elf.
They are essentially the elves, yes.
There's the Furions, which we already mentioned are from the Chronicles of Riddick. They're the half-orcs. They're the cat people.
Well, they, specifically, in the lore, they were actually made out of the molten rock of the earth by one of the gods, and then the lady god said, oh, well, if they're made out of rock, they're going to be too brittle, so she introduced the light of something to soften them.
Nice.
And make them
fleshy.
Like
that. Yeah,
it's good stuff. As you can tell, I read a little bit of the lore. This game has a ton of lore for a first-time project.
Yet another reason I bought it.
Let's finish up the last race is the Afflicted, which kind of have the Forsaken vibe, but it's basically humans that have like the phage, but they're replacing bits of them with like machines as they go. And
this world looks crazy. I mean, you've got the high fantasy concepts, archers, swords, and everything, but then you've got these gigantic flying ships.
It's supposed to be like in a dark age, because the world before had like it was almost like Better Neberon. Like they talked about like giant like Runepunk golems and craziness and really high fantasy, high technology. And then, you know, one of the gods went crazy and just everything got
wrecked.
Yeah, and nobody knows how to build any of this old cool stuff anymore, but a lot of it still works.
I love this image right here of the girl sleeping underneath the frozen hand of the giant golem.
So there's like 9 classes. They've only revealed the names of 3 of them so far. The Sentinel, the Judge, something Hunter, Fell Hunter.
Oh, and in the combat example.
Oh, and the Phantom.
And an Arcanist. They had an Arcanist.
Yeah.
So there's 5.
So the 5 of the classes are named, but there's going to be 9 total classes.
Looks like they each have 2 builds.
It depends. Some of them have 2, some of them have more builds, actually.
Okay.
First of all, one thing to get out of the way, it owes a lot to 4th edition D&D, which is going to turn some people off, but it shouldn't. It also owes a lot to more modern narrative games like Cypher and Fate, and it's a really interesting mashup of the two. Unlike 4th edition, where everything was like grid-based and had a lot of fiddly modifiers and stuff, this one uses abstract ranges, and it replaces 4th edition's skill system with essentially what are aspects from Fate, where you write a portion of your character's story.
Things that relate to it, you'd get a skill
You get to add a bonus. So, like, the example they give in the character creation is the female Furion character has a story portion called A Warrior's Heart, where she grew up with a family of all brothers and she wanted to be as good as her brothers. And so she's got this, like, very fierce determination. So that applies in any situation where she needs to push through physically. So whether she's swimming, jumping, climbing, and the example they actually give is in a drinking contest. But what's really interesting is the way that you use these is not just, oh, I'm going to apply this aspect and add it to my role. It's you actually do a flashback to part of your character's backstory and tell a little story about why your character is good at this particular thing. And how well you tell that story is how much of that aspect's bonus you get to apply to your role.
I really like that the GM does not chuck dice.
Yeah, that's straight out of the Cypher system. Yeah, all the monsters have like basically an attack value. You roll your 2d10, you're adding your modifier, and if you beat the attack value, then you don't get hit.
Also, he's taken a lot of other elements from 4th edition and kind of blended them with some ideas from like video games and stuff. Like Rob was telling me, and I read some of these examples, basically like a lot of the characters are designed to have combos with each other. So like essentially one class will use an ability which combines with another class's ability to hit your enemy. Basically, the reason that this game at least gets rules nerds like me and Robert excited is because the mechanics just look extremely well thought out.
But the narrative and the fluffy parts are also there, which is, you know, I like those type of games too. And this looks like kind of like the Reese's Pieces, you know, the chocolate and the peanut butter. It's got the cool crunchy combat and it's got a lot of narrative stuff.
And if you're a fan of like 13th Age or a fan of a game like Cypher, which is kind of, again, in that kind of middle ground between narrative and crunch, this game will probably definitely appeal to you. So I'm pretty optimistic about this one. I think it looks really cool.
It's doing real well. At the time of this recording, with 26 days left to go, it is fully funded. In terms of backing levels, what we're looking at is
it's
a whole
Canadian
lot of Canadian dollars.
Yeah, so it's... The conversion for us U.S. folks is a little weird.
It's about $1.50 to get in on the Kickstarter and get updates. $19 for the digital basic, which gets you just the core rulebook in PDF format. $29 for the complete digital package. You get all the unlocked stretch goals plus the Kickstarter adventure. $58 U.S. gets you the book, which is a physical copy of the core rulebook.
And then we start getting into the realms where you get to start adding content.
And then it jumps up to about 200 US and more to create items and characters and classes and stuff. I don't know. I think it's a really neat looking system. I think it's a really neat looking world, and I'm pretty stoked about it.
So that's Unity. Go check it out. Look at the artwork. Definitely watch the videos, by the way. The guy put a lot of work into giving you a lot of videos where he explains a lot of the game's mechanics.
And a 10-page combat example.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the 600-pound elephant in the universe right now. Now for folks in our hobby,
a whole heck of a lot to talk about.
Gen Con is right around the corner. At the time of this recording, we're about 3 weeks away from Gen Con. Yeah, I mean, we all know what's going to happen. Gen Con will splash. There will be a ton of news. There will be a ton of new releases. And then all of us will be eating ramen for the rest of the year.
A lot of stuff will float to the top and be the Gen Con hotness, which I'm kind of curious about what that'll be. You know, like the RPG nerds like you and me, the Ennies will get announced or get rewarded. And we'll probably both be mad that either Monty Cook or WotC took all the awards, because that's what happens every year. And I'll be like, Dracula Dossier, you deserved it! You were robbed!
We voted for you, Ken. We did.
But Board Game Geek has a ton of... they have a long list of all the board games that are coming out. And I started going through it, and I was like, wow, there's a lot of board games. And I was in the seas, and I was like, whoa, I'm running out of steam going through all these board games that are coming out.
It's a sign of the health of the industry, and it's also a sign of... to me, just the chaos that is the board game and RPG industry right now, because there's too much.
Yeah, it's kind of an embarrassment of riches right now if you're a tabletop gamer. And honestly, that's one of the things that I find daunting, is just like picking a game to play sometimes.
Nobody wins.
Yeah.
I'll give you a perfect example. I had to pick one miniatures combat game to go with. I ended up with War Machines because I'm surrounded by other War Machines players, and I really like the universe, and I think the fluff is amazing, and, you know, I love being stompy mechs. But I was right on the edge of maybe four or five other systems. You can't have them all. You really have to kind of draw a line, and it's not fair, because it's not saying that the other systems aren't good or don't deserve your money. It's just there's just too much good stuff right now.
Yeah.
And that goes with board games, that goes with RPGs, that goes with minis games.
There's a lot of good RPGs.
It's ridiculous.
The only real arena where there's not serious competition right now is probably TCGs. Like, Magic is still pretty much top dog there.
Magic is pretty much the only dog. I guess Dragon Ball Z is
Dragon Ball Z is making a comeback, but I mean...
Gen Con.
One interesting tidbit, though, that I do notice here, WotC not attending
in
the official capacity.
I think this is the second year they haven't.
There's going to be D&D Adventures League stuff there, but WotC is not having a booth. And the reason they're saying that is just because Gen Con's too big. Them being the market leader, they're just kind of like, we don't really need to be there.
I can't blame it. It's akin to Nintendo no longer going to E3, because it's not really doing them any favors.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and also, honestly, in a way, it's a little bit magnanimous, because they're basically saying, hey, let some other people have the spotlight. We don't need to be there showing you all the D&D stuff that we know you're going to buy anyway.
So there we go, Gen Con.
Our wonderful friends at Catalyst Games have dipped into the licensed games bucket once more, and this time they've come up with an older license that I did not expect to see on the news, and that is Galaxy Quest.
To me, in my mind, like, if you're going to do Galaxy Quest, the board game, then you have to make it a parody of a Star Trek game, and I don't know any Star Trek games that are considered classics, so
no.
I don't know what they're going to be doing.
Yeah, the most popular Star Trek game that sold at our store when it was open was Star Trek Catan, which is not really a Star Trek game. It's just Settlers of Catan with a Star Trek skin.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean...
And, you know, it's kind of interesting. They're going the right direction with it. They're making it a co-op game.
Which I
appreciate co-op games, because I prefer those.
So not a whole lot of info on that one, but something we'll be keeping our eye on, because we are all fans of Galaxy Quest here.
I've driven you mad with his
Thermian voice.
That is an old
running joke.
That is a very old running joke.
No. So back in the day when we were working in the video game industry, he and our other business partner figured out that it's not that I hate the Thermian voice, but... they did it for like an entire day.
When Rob does the Thermian voice.
Well, no. It's just for an entire day, whenever they spoke to me, it was in the Thermian voice.
Did they now?
They would talk like this all of the time.
And then when Trevor would make a funny, we would go,
Yeah, so they did that to me for like an entire day, and then a day turned into a week, and then they're very lucky that they survived. That, let's
now I know how I'm going to spend the next time we all play Overwatch together talking.
No,
oh my God. You must deliver the payload. We need to beg more time.
My never give up. Super never surrender.
Oh yeah. My God, that has to be a thing.
Yeah. Oh, Lord.
And now we turn back to Kickstarter for a moment.
Ponies for Pathfinder. When I saw it hit Kickstarter initially, I was cynical too, because I'm an awful person. But it funded. It got the guy 20 large. I mean, that's not insignificant for...
No, not at all.
And he has since done two more Kickstarters to expand it, and he releases adventures on DriveThruRPG. And, you know, I mean, it's obviously this guy's side hustle, but he's making money. And he's obviously fulfilling something that people want, so that's cool. And I've always had my eye on it because I think it would be funny. The main thing keeping me back is I don't play Pathfinder. I play 5th edition. And then now he's got a Kickstarter for Ponyfinder 5th edition. I backed it. And here's why. I have a little girl. I want her to play role-playing games. She likes My Little Pony. Now, will she like My Little Pony in 5 years when she's probably a little bit more able to play that? I don't know. But if I can do anything to get, you know, a kid to play 5th edition with me, and if I, you know, if we're going to use a setting that they like, then why not? I mean, I've bought a lot of games for... I bought No Thank You Evil for the same reason, and I bought The Secrets of Cats for Fate. Just to have on hand in case I can rope my kid into role-playing.
Well, and to be fair, that's why I bought Bubblegum Shoe, because I want to run a campaign with my kids and stuff. And in that respect, I'm kind of glad that you backed it, because I would gladly offer up my daughters and say, let's all go play some Pony Finder. And, heck, my sons too, if they're interested. It's one of those things that you come across it on Kickstarter and you're like, is this legit? Is this for real? And then when you realize just how legit it is, it's funny. I can't help it. I laugh.
Thanks. And I'll say it, like, there are shows that my kids watch that I will watch episodes of when they're not there because I'm like, I want to know what happens next. And Scooby-Doo Mysteries Incorporated was one of them, and so was My Little Pony, because frickin' John DeLance was on a queue, and I was like, and he's basically playing Q. And I was really getting into it. I'm like, I want to know what Q's going to do next. It's not a bad show. I do enjoy it. It's one of those things. It's not like Caillou. It's not when I come on. I just...
By the way, for anyone in the audience who is a parent and has had to endure Caillou,
we're sorry.
Yeah. We get it.
Yeah, this is my house. So, like, you see a picture of me, the kid turns on the TV, Caillou's on. She's like, Daddy, I'm going to watch Caillou. And then you see a few frames of Caillou, and it comes back to me, and I'm like that girl in the ring, and I'm just...
I can't stand Caillou. I would rather sand with sandpaper.
Yeah.
Or shave with sandpaper.
I think the best thing I've ever seen was something on the internet was like someone was like, why doesn't Caillou have any hair? And it's like, and it's like, because he doesn't deserve hair, because Caillou sucks. was like the top rated answer on Yahoo Answers or
awesome.
Something. Like, yeah.
So anyway, they're going to convert all of the previous source books from Pony Finder as they rack their way up with stretch goals.
And on the Kickstarter, you have the option of backing it and paying an extra $15 for a muffin plushie.
One thing to clarify, Pony Finder is not actually based on My Little Pony.
Pony Finder, it's a thing, and now it's coming to 5th edition, where it will continue being a thing for many, many people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll get it. I'll write a review.
I will go on record as saying this. I will gladly play it once, and if I am completely wrong about it, I will gladly say that.
Okay.
All right,
that's it. That sounds like, because there's going to be an adventure, apparently. So.
Just foreshadowing for the future, there's going to be the Jonathan's Massive Mea Culpa episode where he admits that Pony Finder is awesome. I will totally
fess up to it. All right, let's round out our news. And our last item here is, actually, I thought that this was particularly interesting. Last year on Kickstarter, video games were out-earned by board games at a 6-to-1 ratio.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, you know, I think we're going to see a very similar trend to what happened with video games. I think right now board games are on an upswing, but mm-hmm. the exact same thing is going to happen, where we're going to have this diluted marketplace where there's just too much. There's a ton of excellent board games on Kickstarter at any given time, but you only have so many dollars to go, right? So you can only back one or two, and then that money kind of starts to get centralized into specific...
Yeah, I saw the same thing happen in RPG Kickstarters, where you know, Monty was one of the early adopters, and so his tend to do well, but... The names draw people. You know, the weird little one-offs, like those being hits, or and by hits I mean making absurd amounts of money. Those tend to be kind of rare.
Yeah. And I think that's what we're going to see with board games eventually, too. I think what we're seeing now is something that's on the upswing, and it's going to follow the same curve.
One thing that would be nice to see in crowdfunding in general is for things to kind of normalize to where, A, crowdfunding is no longer the go-to method for every single project that goes into development, because I think right now the games industry in general is far too reliant on crowdfunding, and traditionally funded products, which tend to be better. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. There tends to be a little bit of a quality gap sometimes. Now, granted, there are crowdfunded projects that are significantly higher quality than traditionally funded things.
But we're going to actually talk about one of them.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that the traditional funding model has the advantage of it weeds out things that are either too niche or with people that aren't serious or that are just bad ideas. And with crowdfunding, sometimes a project that falls into one of those three categories can get some traction on a crowdfunding thing, come out, and be a huge disappointment. If it had been going through any kind of traditional development process, some producer somewhere would have been like, no, we're shutting this down. I don't know. That was my rant.
That was our rant about Kickstarters. Or the board gaming's doing better than the video gaming.
I don't know. I mean, like, I see both sides of the coin, right? I mean, the other side of that coin is that crowdfunding gives some folks that normally wouldn't have had an opportunity to jump into the industry.
Like Unity.
Yeah. Or like Ryan Lockett, who's now on his 7th or 8th Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Jamie Stegmaier, who's now on his 4th or 5th and producing just amazing games.
Well, and like, I think Cool Mini or Not owes their entire
company is all funded by Kickstarter. Yeah. So, I mean,
well, and just the niche good things that are hard to get published, because people are like, well, nobody wants another edition of Delta Green. It's like, well, $300,000 tells me differently.
They were able to directly connect with the consumers that wanted it and, you know, come off with a print run that was a perfectly sized print run with no risk. And there is a spot for that. I just think that what we're going to see is a lot of consolidation. And I think that people are going to be a little smarter with their money. And now it's time for us to go into our deep dive of Scythe, the new game from Stonemaier Games. And I don't know about you guys, but I was really impressed with this game.
I liked it a lot. Considering the concept and where it came from, they did a really good job. And we're going to talk about all the aspects of this game, but let's talk about first impressions first. Robert, what'd you think?
Well, I'm getting kind of jaded by pretty board games, because there's a lot of pretty board games right now. That being said, this was a really pretty board game. In particular, the thing I really dug about it was you got the deluxe version, so it had a whole bunch of little glittering metal coins.
Yes.
And it was fun because the coins were themed around the different factions. And then they, for the resources, instead of just having dumb tokens or anything like that, they actually gave you like little three-dimensional, I guess they're resin.
Pre-painted, no less.
Yeah. And the log one looked like Log from Ren and Stimpy, which was amazing.
I'm pretty sure that I sang the theme song.
It was glorious.
I didn't really know what to think. I was looking at it, and I mean, I recognize the artwork, because if for those of you that don't know, this is actually based on artwork done by a gentleman on the internet whose name...
Jacob Rosalski,
who... His artwork was kind of circulating around the, like, Reddit, Imgur, social media scene.
I think I saw an article on him on IO9.
Yeah. And, you know, his stuff got relatively popular, and they actually based the game on the scenes in his artwork, which are kind of these...
He's created this whole alternate world.
It's like an alternate history World War I, World War II era thing, but they're big mechs.
Yeah, it's early 1900s Europe with giant stompy mechs.
And maybe this is where my sitting down and playing a game with a cynical heart does me wrong. I was not expecting this to be a good game. When someone's like, that artwork's cool, I should make a board game out of it, I was not expecting it to actually be done well. And I my face is red. It was actually done incredibly well.
Yeah, my first impression, I didn't really have much of one. I thought it looked very complicated. There were a lot of bits. As soon as we cracked the box,
it's very, very intimidating when you first crack the box.
It's like Fantasy Flight level of crud.
Yeah, it's a big box. There's a lot of stuff, and again, much like Robert, I was kind of like, okay, this has got neat artwork, but is it actually going to be a good game? Jonathan, what about you?
Well, I mean, I came in with some pretty high expectations, and not because Scythe got a lot of hype off the internet, but I came in with high expectations because I am absolutely head over heels in love with Viticulture, which was Stonemaier's last game.
Mm-hmm.
Viticulture's a phenomenal worker placement Euro-style game, and, you know, how can you make winemaking interesting for a board game, and yet that game is hugely engaging and one of my favorites. So I had a whole lot of high expectations, and I got to be honest with you, the hype actually worked against me. It made me worried that the game wasn't going to live up to my expectations. You know, kind of.
Okay. Well, I've seen, like I said, there's an article about this on IO9, and I've seen a couple of other videos floating around too, and it's like everybody's like, this game's amazing. And I'm like,
yeah,
this game can't be that amazing.
And I kind of came into it with the same idea. I was trying to keep my expectations lowered because I was like, well, I mean, like, can it really be better than Viticulture? Because I really hold that game on a very high level. And, you know, when I first opened up the box, I was hugely intimidated by both the yeah, physical weight of the box, because, I mean, the thing weighs like 14 pounds, no joke, and just the huge amount of bits inside the box. But I think once we kind of cracked into it, we started to realize very early on that there's the game is not nearly as complicated
it's not,
as it seems.
It's not as fiddly as it looks. It's still kind of fiddly, but we'll get into that more when we get into the actual gameplay. So we've already kind of touched on this, but unboxing it, let's kind of go through the exterior of the box is gorgeous.
Yeah, the artwork is gorgeous. The quality of the box itself, it's very thick cardboard. It's a really nice box, and really nice on the outside of the base of the box. There's actually a diagram printed that shows you kind of how to get everything back in the box, which is hugely helpful because there's so many bits in this game.
There are so many. Yeah, and we followed that little thing, and
the diagram's gorgeous.
Yeah,
it's perfect.
It worked. It's boom, 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 boom. Yeah, and it's all back in there.
And once you crack into the box, it's kind of nice. One of the first things I noticed, of course, was that it comes with plastic baggies, which I know just seems like such a silly thing
like,
to get
extra plastic.
Oh,
baggies.
Huge amounts. Yeah, yeah. And you know, I know that seems like a silly thing to get excited about, but so many games these days don't come with any kind of storage option in the box, and I'm just so sick of spending $60 to $100 on like a Fantasy Flight game and getting the Death Star trench with no storage option for my stuff.
Yeah, and then you have to like go into your kitchen and pull out the Ziplocs your game adequately. Yeah.
The other singular component that jumped out at me, because it's not something I've ever seen in a board game before, I mean, beyond all the little wooden bits, beyond the metal coins, beyond everything, the deluxe version comes with 4 of these, and then the standard version comes with 2, so the retail version will come with 2. They're plastic clamshells that clip together very nicely. And you can use them to store bits when you're not playing the game. And they unfold and become little storage cups that you can use during the game to kind of keep all your tokens and your bits kind of
I know what you're
corralled.
Thinking out there, gentle listener. I thought it was stupid, too. When you were pulling it out and you were so impressed with it, Jonathan, I thought you were smoking something. and then actually using them during gameplay, and it was actually really handy.
Kept everything nice and tidy. We didn't have to ever reach for tokens. Everything was nice and accessible.
And, yeah, and you can even, if someone needs a particular thing of tokens, you can even just pick up the little dish, pass it to them, and then put it back. And
it's the dumbest thing ever. And if you haven't seen it, you're probably like, what's the big deal about little... It's awesome. It's really good.
That 4-cent part that really just adds so much to the whole package.
Yeah, so again, a lot of thought into the packaging and very, very well done.
The next thing I noticed was just the quality of the cardboard bits, like the player mats. I mean, like they've put a lot of thought into the individual components. And one of them is the mat that stores all of your cubes for your actions. Actually, it's dual-layered cardboard with the top layer cut out so that the cubes and the bits actually nestle in.
And that actually, what's really neat about that, this is actually one of the things that I thought was kind of brilliant about this game. So the cards that you use to keep track of your actions and your resources and stuff have these little, you know, indentations where you can place various bits. And it actually becomes part of the mechanics of the game, because when you pull something out of one of those indentations, it reveals something that changes the mechanics of how things work.
It changes the iconography on your player sheet, which changes the cost associated with any given action.
Yeah, or if you uncover new technologies or the recruit action or build certain buildings, it actually gives you different benefits for doing various actions, which is very cool.
Yeah, I think the out-of-the-box experience is pretty impressive. There's not a single component in the box that lacks in this high level of polish and quality. Everything is absolutely beautiful, including every different faction has meeples, and yet they manage to shape every faction's meeples individually. So
yeah, my Rusviet faction meeples had little Yushchenkas on their head. Oh, and another thing that they actually call out in the rule book, which is also very smart design, the wooden components all have non-combat functions, and the plastic components are the all of the combat functions.
Yeah.
So if you're ever trying to figure out if a unit can fight or not, it's real easy, because if it's plastic, it can fight. If it's wood, it can't.
Yeah.
Just a very simple, like, kind of visual and tactile shorthand, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's one of the many nice little touches that this game has. It just, to me, this is the high bar for attention to detail when putting together a full component list.
All right, so the theme of this game, which, as we said, is based on these pieces of artwork depicting kind of these pastoral scenes... With giant robots in the background. It's basically Europe. I was playing the Rusviets, which are very obviously Russian Soviets. It's kind of like set in sort of World War One or Two-ish, but it's... I don't think everyone's supposed to be at war. Like, the setting kind of goes into some detail about what's going on, but it's...
Well, and they even state in the rules that combat is a reasonably rare occurrence. Now,
which does tie into a problem I have with the game, but we'll get into that in a minute. But,
basically, in the fluff, you've got these five nations, and they're all after this factory in the center of the board.
I mean,
that's kind of what the fluff is creating. It's like, this is like the last virgin land of resources, and everybody's trying to do a land grab, and the ultimate prize is this factory in the center, when you get to the factory, actually gives you a humongous change to your gameplay.
We'll
cover that in a moment as well.
Yeah, and overall, like, you basically play as this powerful leader with your mechs moving across this countryside, and you have peasant farmers that work for you and generate your resources, basically.
Well, you actually do have a character, and that's the character
you have
miniature
a named
that comes
character,
with it, which is neat.
And all of the characters have an animal companion, which is themed to their nation. Like, I had a Siberian tiger, and yours was like a dire wolf, basically.
Yeah, mine was a wolf.
So overall, like, you know, it has this kind of, like, fantasy, alt-history Europe thing going for it, which, I mean, it's nothing we haven't seen before. Like, I mean, I won't give it, like excellent marks for creativity, but at the same time, it's very effective for conveying what they're trying to convey.
Yeah.
And so
I do have to say one thing about the factions. I was glad that they did not make a villain. You know, there wasn't a bad faction versus a good faction. It's every country is after the same thing. Every country's trying to survive and make resources, and it's not a bad or a good to it. It's just they're all trying to grab the same last patch of land.
Yeah, and actually the other thing that's kind of interesting is through the course of the gameplay, you can kind of decide whether to individually be bad or good with one of the game mechanics, which is popularity, which we'll talk about when we run
and I
down
spent that. My popularity.
Yeah, Robert was a ruthless dictator.
I was
in
a
our
ruthless,
game.
The
yeah.
ruthless Saxons.
So yeah. So let's move into to gameplay now. And, you know, I've played a lot of 4X games. I've played a lot of Civilization-style games, and I've never seen a rule set that, after you get the iconography and sit down with it for a couple of turns, was, to me, just so fast and smooth.
Yeah, it's very fast playing, and they even state in the rules, like, if you're not going to be interacting with another player, have them go ahead and start taking their turn while you clean up your turn. Because essentially the way that the sequence of this turn works is you have a little peg that you place on a part of your card that states what action you're going to be taking for the turn. And each section of the card has a top row action, which you do first at the start of your turn. You resolve everything there. And then you have a bottom row action, which is everything you resolve at the end of your turn. Which, when you're first reading the instructions, that was a little confusing for me, but once you actually start doing it, it's very intuitive, and it's very like, oh, okay, I do all of this stuff first, resolve all of these effects, and now it's It's if you played like Magic the Gathering or a miniatures war game, it's very much like there's just phases of the turn. You just follow the phases of the turn and you're good.
And I think it should be said that the bottom thing you don't necessarily always do.
Yeah, no, because
especially at the beginning of
the game. Yeah, because there's cost and resources to do some of it and you just won't always have the resources.
Top row actions tend to be very inexpensive free. You know,
or they generate resources.
But the bottom row actions all come with an associated resource cost, and if you have not spent any turns building up those resources, you're not going to be able to afford them, which is why they're optional.
And this is also one of the interesting points in the game. So all of these sheets that we're talking about, you get two. You get one for your faction, and you get one for this type of player you are. And the type of players differ.
Yeah, so what it is that the order that they are on your card is different. So you can have a different top row action paired with a different bottom row action. So the top row action versus the bottom row action on each of the individual cards will not be the same.
Yeah.
And you are supposed to deal out both the faction card and the bottom cards randomly every game. And so every time you play this game, you're going to have a different combination of faction ability, and then also on the bottom row cards, the cost of things are different.
Yeah, sometimes wildly from one another.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed there was a pattern. Like, you basically have your cheapies, you have two sort of middling costs, and then you have the expensive thing. But what is the expensive thing to generate is different on every card. And
right.
it really does affect your gameplay quite a bit. And it's interesting because, like, the Saxons, and I think I got the Industrial one, that teamed up actually oddly well with what I was able to do.
Yeah, because you were able to...
you were very effective.
Yeah, Robert got a combination that let him make his mechs extremely cheap.
Yeah.
And he was able to get them all in play significantly faster than either Jonathan or I could.
Yeah, I had them all out, and you guys only had, like, two.
Yeah.
And you can have a max of four.
I think both of us only had one when you maxed.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But by the end of the game, I think you guys didn't give above two, and I just...
I eventually got all of mine.
Okay, yeah. That's right.
But still, yeah. So you get, like, kind of interesting nuances like that, where essentially you're going to have a different experience every time you play.
And I would just like to say this. I am incredibly dense when it comes to board games. It takes me a while to get them, and it's because I do this thing where I can't think about them rationally. I have to, like, feel it. And this game, like, clicked with me so fast.
Yeah,
the intention of everything was just obvious, and I got what I was supposed to do. Intuitive.
We took a lot of time with the instruction book, and it was intimidating. Like, it took a long time to kind of try and figure it out. And then I remember about halfway through the first turn, when we started really kind of fumbling around through the system, we all kind of had that click moment where it all just unfolded. And after that, we barely referenced rules.
We only had to flip back in the rule book like twice.
Yeah, which is for a first time play of a game with this kind of complexity, it's really unheard of.
So, by the way, I do want to kind of throw in just a little bit more of an impression of what this game is like, because it actually is very similar to some other games that I've played before. For anyone who has played Twilight Imperium, this game is very close to Twilight Imperium, although it is significantly simpler and faster to play and does not have nearly as much interaction as Twilight Imperium.
Well, and when you say simple, that's not necessarily a bad
thing. No, it's not necessarily a bad thing. What I mean is that it is... Twilight Imperium is notorious for taking forever to play.
And I tried learning it, and it...
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I tried to approach that game from nobody knew it, and we never figured it out. And we played for like 20
hours. But the ways that it is similar to TI is that the faction cards are similar in that you have a faction card that tells you kind of what your abilities are. And also, the method of claiming victory points is exactly the same as Twilight Imperium. There is a track on the board with different types of goals you can fulfill that you place a marker on whenever you fulfill them. And that is how you score. It also has a few things in common with the Game of Thrones board game, which is an excellent board game. If you have not played it, I strongly recommend it. In that it has a couple of resource tracks that you kind of move up and down, and your relative position to the other players matters. It's just combat and popularity in this one. In Game of Thrones, there's like there's military power and the king's court. In this one, it's combat power and popularity.
Yeah,
and you spend combat power is exactly what you think. You spend it as a resource when you're fighting, which never came up in our game.
And yeah.
Jonathan maxed that out really early, and we were all intimidated by him. And then,
yeah. none of us could mess with Jonathan.
And then I started out fairly high in popularity, and I'm like, screw it, I'll just spend it all I want. Like, I don't care.
Yeah, Rob just burned. Because basically, popularity is if you do something nice for the peasants in one of your. We should probably mention there's a mechanic called encounters where. As your character moves around the board, you can hit these encounters, and essentially every encounter works the same way. You have three choices. You have be nice to the peasants and gain popularity and a small amount of a resource, give the peasants money and get a larger amount of a resource, or be mean to the peasants, go down in popularity, and get a substantially larger amount of resource. And
use
Robert,
your popularity.
Yeah, Robert... discovered it was very advantageous to just burn your popularity and get lots of resources.
Well, it got me resources to build mechs quickly, which is, yeah. It just seemed like a thing to do, and it worked.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was your combo, right? Because, like, when I looked down at my playing field, burning popularity was a bad thing. Like, I would find myself out of resources if I did that.
Well, and the thing that also changes this is that everyone has secret goals, which is another Twilight Imperium mechanic, which has been imitated in this, which is that your secret goal may depend on you being at a certain point on one of these tracks.
Yep. Yep.
So how you spend these resources is going to be dictated by the combination of your faction cards and what goals you're trying to achieve to win the game. And that is the biggest strength of this game that I'm going to call out right now. There is a large variety to the strategies you can employ to win.
And I think that's, to me, that's where this game succeeds at its highest amount. I mean, like, we all played distinctly different strategies. I only had two workers until about the halfway point of the game because I was going after a secret goal. And yet, I was in second place on the score.
Yeah.
You guys maxed out worker. Well, you maxed out workers.
I maxed out workers
quickly,
very
Trevor.
Fast because my faction accommodated that.
And you were 1 point behind me in the score. And then Robert completely took it a different track, and he was pumping out mechs like crazy. And you know,
and I took the most land because I
yeah,
was
Robert,
on the
Robert
board,
expanded
I was
very
it was
fast.
A land grab.
Yeah.
And you know, you expanded the most, Robert. I had a very dense empire, but I was farming the exact same resource, and I actually had a good resource farming combo going.
Yeah.
And I was able to produce resources for second actions a lot quicker than some of you guys.
Yeah, and I was trying to get my buildings all built, and I almost succeeded. I got all but one of my buildings built, and I also was the first one to take the factory, which gives you the benefit of choosing your factory card first.
Which adds an entire another action to the board. I mean,
you basically get a new
action,
section of
which
your
is amazing.
Sheet.
And here's the thing, too. I never even bothered with the factory, and I still won. The theme of the game is to go after the factory, and you don't even have to do that. Like, it's really cool.
Yeah. That's going to bring us into game balance, which we're kind of going to naturally sort of segue into this. The one call-out that I have about the balance of the game, we were only playing it with three players. And I think that the balance is going to improve the more players that you have. Because one of the things we discovered with the three of us is that we all just tended to turtle up and go for our easy points, basically. And we never got into combat because there really was no advantage to doing so. But, of course, that meant that when Robert hit the point where he was about to win, and we could tell he was about to win, we couldn't really do anything about it. It was like he was too far away for us to move our mechs into position to attack him.
Well, and I think that's because with three players, there's enough resources on the board where, you know, you can expand outward and not run into somebody else and have enough that you're never starving.
Right.
With a five-player game going,
land would be the much more premium.
I think of Robert's strategy and how he spread out on the south side of the board because he wasn't near us. And
one of my secret goals was to take over the tunnels. And also one of my faction's abilities was I could score things twice where ordinarily you can't. And so I looked and it was like really easy for me to score both of my things with all of my mechs out. So I was like, oh, I'll go do that.
Yeah.
And then I just left my mechs there because I didn't care.
Well, but your land grab was amazing. I mean, you had a disproportionate amount of the board. And yet we still never felt the urge to battle each other. I think, Trevor, you thought about it
once. I
saw you looking at my borders.
Well, I thought about attacking you one time only to try to kick you off the factory because that was one of my secret goals.
And then you looked at my maxed out.
Well, yeah, because the other part of that secret goal was I had to be the highest in military power, which I was, like, nowhere close to getting. And I also did think about trying to go attack Robert to try to keep him from winning the game, But again, it was kind of one of those things where it's just the way that the board is laid out, I was not in a good position to do so.
Now, before we talk about balance real quick, I do want to talk about combat, because combat's handled in an interesting way. There are no dice in this game.
Yeah, this is a diceless game, and it is actually, which again, similar to Game of Thrones, but it does handle things a lot differently than the Game of Thrones game. It has these dials.
And that's how many points you're going to gamble off of your combat track to...
And it's 0 to 7.
0 to 7.
So you have a combat track that goes up to 16, but you can only spend 7 in a single battle. But you also have these cards that can add a certain amount to the battle, and the cards are very simple. That is one thing I was going to call out too, is a slight disappointment. They could have done a little bit more with the combat cards.
Yeah. You spin the dial to the appropriate amount that you want,
and then you tuck a card. So each mech or character participating in the battle can get one card, because one of the faction special abilities is you can play 2 per mech or character.
Well, and then you tuck those cards in behind the dial, and it's all done in secret.
So you lay them face down.
Yeah. Your opponents don't even necessarily know if you have tucked a card at all.
Yeah. And they don't know how much you've spent.
Yeah, and then you reveal, and then... But if you spend points off the combat track, then you lose points off the combat track. Yeah. That's a resource that...
Even if you lose the battle.
Yeah.
Even if you win the battle. You go down... Yeah. So anytime you're fighting, you are losing resources, which again, fits with the kind of like...
Also, you lose popularity if you start pushing the workers.
That is the interesting effect. Combat does come with a cost, and that cost is popularity. You can be successful at combat, and you can intentionally go after combat if you want, but your popularity is going to take a hit every time, because however many workers you displace equals the number of points that you lose off of your popularity track.
Right, and again, if depending on the kind of strategy you're going, that may not matter to you at all. I mean,
because it can't go below zero. If you get to zero, you're fine.
It can't go below zero. Now, that does mean you can't spend popularity, though. So when you hit those quests we were talking about, you won't be able to take the third option anymore. Yeah.
But if you're kicking the workers around, if you're at zero, it's like, okay, fine.
Yeah, just keep kicking them around, yeah. So I mean, like I said, there's some small balance concerns, but I think those would go away in a larger game. And I do like the fact that, again, that there's a pretty wide variety of strategies. And the big takeaway of this, too, is that, like, I felt like I was getting my butt kicked the whole game.
Both Robert and I thought you were completely out of the game. We were both... talking about it the next day, how surprised we were.
Yeah.
How you came storming back and were within a point of second
place.
Yeah.
Our the point spread of our game was 3 points. It went 34, 35, 36 after we did the end game scoring. So as long as you are doing work, as long as you're taking your turns and like trying to accomplish goals, you're in it. This seems like the kind of game where you will almost never be totally out of the game, and it will always be close.
Yeah, we each had a completely different approach to the mechanisms of the game, and we each ended up within a point of each other, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
That's a well-balanced game.
So I don't think that there's any real concerns about the balance between like different cards or different factions. It's more just about the fact that it's a little hard to disrupt somebody who's really far ahead. And again, I think that problem would disappear in a 5-player game.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I think ideally this is one where if you can max it out, you should just max it out.
And
yeah.
it definitely feels like that was the sweet spot they were going for. Let's talk about the instructions for a moment. I found them to be like some of the better instructions that I've read in a board game.
Even though the instructions were long, it is a pretty dense instruction book. If you follow them word for word, you will be able to play the game. Like we said, once we started playing, we really didn't have to refer back to them that much. Like it went very smoothly. So I would give this a pretty high rating for instruction quality. But yeah, so let's get down to the big question. This is kind of the only thing that we give that's close to a grade on Forgot My Dice. Is it fun, Rob?
Yeah, I liked it. I was actually shocked. Like I typically shy away from competitive board games. I was really pleasantly surprised. This is like the theme of this episode. I came into something cynical and was very pleasantly surprised. I've never had a game click in my head that fast, and I'm awful at learning new games, and it just blew my mind that it was that intuitive. And I play a very like muscle memory kind of game, and that's how I get into things. And it was easy. Like, once we did it, it was easy. And it just blew my mind that I got that game that quickly. That's never happened to me before. Right. I mean, not at that complexity level. Like, you know, yeah. I just got it. It blew my mind. It is a fantastic game for that.
What about you, Trevor?
I definitely give this one a thumbs up. It's definitely my kind of game. I've always enjoyed kind of territory conquering strategy games. Risk was a big thing in my family. I love 4X computer games like Civilization and Master of Orion, we've talked about before. And I really like Twilight Imperium and the Game of Thrones board games, which, like I said, are like seem to be kind of the two biggest mechanical influences on this one. And it's also got a little bit of a historical fiction twist, which is a big one for me. So this game pretty much hit on all points with me. Like I said, I the only criticisms I had of it are like so minor that I can't really even dwell on them. So yeah, gets a big thumbs up. I had a good time, would play it again. And going back to what Robert said, yeah, it definitely has a very like intuitive, fast paced to the play, and I think that most people would probably get this pretty easily. Going back to a game we talked about earlier, it kind of reminded me of the first time I played Lords of Waterdeep, mm-hmm. with kind of that that blend of multiple styles of game. You know, work. It had a blend of worker placement, blend of resource management. It definitely had a similar feeling of like how quickly the concept and the strategy kind of came together, and I never felt like. I never felt like I was like blindly stumbling along. It was clear what you're supposed to do, and there were lots of ways to approach it. So definitely good.
Another thing, like Lords of Waterdeep, in Lords of Waterdeep, you go around the table placing your agents, and this one kind of has the same thing where you just take a turn, and what you do on your individual little turn is in essence pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, there's never this point where you're just sitting there and you're like, oh my god, would he finish up his turn? It's been 10 minutes, because it's just like. You know, I got to take a new action. I got to pick one of these three. Boom, boom, do, 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 do.
And that is kind of nice, because so often with 4X games, especially, you get that 20 to 40 minutes in between turns, which is just painful.
Yeah.
I remember when we played Forbidden Stars for the first time, it was a 6.5-hour marathon to play the game for the first time, and sometimes there would be upwards of 40 minutes in between turns.
Yeah, no, this does not have that problem. Yeah, if you are worried about a strategy game taking too long, this is not a game to worry about.
This is not the one that you're going to worry
like,
about.
Yeah, like I think our total gameplay time was like maybe 90 minutes.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. It averages. Well, it says it averages 115 at 5-player.
Jonathan, what do you think?
This game does it for me on every single level. It's smartly put together from a packaging standpoint. It's smartly put together from a component standpoint. Even like down to the iconography, like, you know, I think that's why it clicks so readily with all of us. It's you look down and everything makes sense. Once you learn the language that they're talking to you in, it all clicks. It's all smartly woven together so that you're never sitting there questioning what you're supposed to do. It just doesn't come up. It's very straightforward. I love how fast it plays. You're never more than about 4 minutes away from your next turn, which is really rare with a game of this scope.
Yeah.
I love the little attention to detail in from the meeples all being individualized to their factions to the artwork itself and how beautiful it is. And,
oh, by the way, we didn't talk about the mechs.
No, the mechs are awesome.
The mechs look great.
Yeah, the mechs are phenomenal.
I can't believe we neglected to mention that till now.
Every faction they look gets awesome. Their own. Every faction looks very, very specific to their
Well,
to
and
their
it makes
country.
Sense, because you had the faction that could go across seas.
Yeah.
And so yours like, were like boats,
like
with,
boats
legs.
With legs.
And mine being the Rusviets, they had big old sickles for arms,
which
is
awesome.
And
yeah.
I had...
But, I mean, just there's not a single aspect to this game that doesn't show that fine detail orientation, and it all comes together just fantastically. I mean, I will be hard pressed to find a game that I will be more impressed with this year. I think this is a clear number one for me for game of the year at the moment.
It sets such a high bar.
Oh yeah. I know, in every respect. And honestly, like, this game comes out of a Kickstarter, and I mean, I think you get such an amazing package here too, because we haven't even talked about the single player mode. There's an entire two decks of additional cards that you can play through as a single player. They call it the Automa mode. When you look at the value of the components you're getting, and when you look at the value of the gameplay that you're getting, and the fact that there's a single player mode in there as well as this amazing 5-player game, how do you even encapsulate that value?
Yeah, and actually, honestly, this game to me seems like it is ripe for expansions. It would be very easy for them to slap an expansion board on here. They've already got placeholders on the board for two new factions. I just think it's a good purchase. As with all board games, like what does this guy retail for?
Okay, so the retail version is going to go for $80.
Ooh, that is
But when you stop and think about that, that's cheap.
Like there's so much stuff
for a box this big. Yeah, $80 is that's what I'd expect.
You know, I compare it to something like Imperial Assault, which is $100 and comes with less stuff. And frankly, you know,
just as good of a game, mind you.
Just as good as a game. But I mean, like from a material standpoint, I get it. I mean, every faction has individual meeples, and there's a ton of wood in this box too. But I mean, yeah, I think for $80 you get a complete package, and you know, it's a phenomenal one at that. And I think that the game itself is really just genuinely amazing. I mean, I'm just, as much as I loved Viticulture, I like this one even more because it's just so elegant. I mean, that's the
point. And it's pretty creative. It's got, like I said, a good variety of strategies. So if you are a strategy gamer who likes that kind of thing, you will really enjoy this. If you're not a strategy gamer,
which
you can still have fun with it, apparently.
I was just like, I'll just make mechs and take the tunnels. Awesome.
Yeah,
I was so impressed at the end when we looked down at our scores and we were all within a point.
That blew my mind.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you would have had half our points.
Overall, fast, fun, still very in depth. Good strategy game. Scythe gets a thumbs up.
Yeah, thumbs up.
I think that it's going to take a very special game to knock this off the pedestal of best game of the year for me. And that brings us to the end of yet another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Remember, you can contact us on our Facebook page, Forgot My Dice. You can also hit us up directly on our website. We have a couple of contact links there. You can comment on any of the articles or on the podcast using your Facebook account. You can tweet at us at Forgot My Dice.
And don't forget Pinterest, where we have a Pinterest account where we post stuff too.
Yes.
And don't forget, if you like us or you want to have more people find out about us, give us a review on iTunes. That is actually very, very useful.
Yeah, or if you hate us, give us a review on iTunes.
That's true.
Tell us so.
Alternatively, you could give us a good review on the Google Store or on Stitcher. You can find the podcast there. And I think our next episode is going to be the number one.
Yeah.
So I think we're going for September. So I should like have twins. And it'll be we will see if I will be here. You know, maybe I'll just be a voice coming in from the ether.
Yeah, so maybe on... so hopefully our official episode one, since this is episode 0.5, I guess.
5. I love lamp.
We'll be having it in September, and yeah, Robert will be baby-brained and
yeah,
insane.
It should be loads of fun. Yeah. I think I'm random now. I'm just waiting until I haven't slept in 5 days.
So as always, leave us lots of feedback on how to make the show better. We are still in our growing phase as we prepare for our first true episode, which will be coming in September, along with Robert's twins.
August, technically, but whatever. They'll be around by then, I'm sure.
And then, until then,
be excellent to each other,
and party on, dudes.
Party on, dudes.
X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire.